a Rayo Original podcast.
Beware a Book contains references to sexual violence and murder, including in this episode, child sexual abuse, which some listeners may find upsetting.
God, I don't... I feel like this is the proper police car park with all the service vehicles and sirens.
12 months, 3 weeks and 6 days. That's how long we've waited for this moment. How long the investigation has taken to get us to this point.
Okay,
here we are.
I'll keep this.
The destination is on your left.
The chance to sit down with police, to ask the questions that have built up over the stacks of interviews, door knocks, calls and emails. The chance to finally get some answers. It might sound like a long time, but it's nothing compared to the families who have been left in silence for decades.
It's just been a nightmare for all the family. Like my girl and my son, he is looking, you know what I mean? He's driving about. He says, I'll get you. I don't care how long it takes.
Over the past few episodes of Beware Book, we've taken you through a series of brutal murders that struck Glasgow in the 1990s and early noughties. Diane McAnally, Karen McGregor, Marjorie Roberts, Jacqueline Gallagher, Leona McGovern, Tracy Wilde, Margot Lafferty and Emma Caldwell. 8 women, mothers, daughters, sisters, all killed in cold blood.
And out of these 8 deaths, only 3 men have ever been convicted. Even then, those verdicts took decades to secure, leaving killers roaming free and victims feeling even more let down.
I would rather be sexually assaulted than go to Strathclyde fucking place. And that's the BL and end all of that.
Huddled together on a cold street corner, putting their faith in each other for protection, scrawling warnings about the most dangerous men stalking the city streets in the Beware Book. But what secrets do its pages contain?
Perhaps the name of the man we now know killed Emma Caldwell back in 2005, or maybe even those connected to the authorities.
I wouldn't say names were put down, I would say registrations.
But do you think that police and people in the legal profession were clients of these girls?
I dare say, yeah.
And why is this book now missing?
It would have been a very destructive piece of evidence if the bosses were looking to go down another line with inquiry.
So you think it could have been damning for them?
Yes.
We take all of these questions and more to those who made the decisions at the time. Are we able to hold them to account?
Can we finally get the victims' families the answers they so deeply deserve? And has anything really changed since those dark days on the city's red light district known as the Drag? I'm Colette McGonagall.
And I'm Callum McQuaid.
And this is the final episode of Beware Book. Working on this podcast for over a year at this point has been a defining moment for us.
The investigations we've carried out and the connections we've built. And it feels pretty daunting now, trying to pull all the threads together in the hopes of finally finding some answers.
Like when a TV detective pins all the important facts and faces on a board, connected by a crisscross of red string, finally leading to that moment where everything suddenly falls into place. And as we sit outside Fettes Police Station in Edinburgh, we're really hoping this next interview will help us join those all-important dots.
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to phone, let her know you're here, and then I'll make up some passes for
Great.
You. Okay?
Brilliant, thank
okay.
you.
Okay,
that's fine.
After a few minutes of nervous chit-chat, we're shown through the reception along a winding corridor and into a narrow lift which takes us up to the top floor. What was a state-of-the-art facility when it opened in 1974, but now shows obvious signs of age. The half-filled file boxes we pass on the way to our destination, a telltale sign that the force looks set to move to a newer, less expensive headquarters in the near future.
We wind up in a bright, airy office with a clear view of the imposing Fettes College, a private boarding school that dates back to the 1800s. And at the table in front of us sits the man we hope can help us with at least some of the answers we're looking for.
Okay, do you want to start with maybe a level check if you want to give us your full name and rank, please?
Sure. So my name's Stevie Bertram. I am a detective superintendent for Police Scotland.
How's that looking?
Yep, that's looking good, and our levels are sounding good as well.
Yeah.
An important thing to set out here is that, unlike Stuart and Davey, who you've already heard from, DS Bertram, or Stevie as he likes to go by, is still a serving police officer. He also isn't a representative of Strathclyde Police, which was the local force responsible for the initial inquiries into the deaths of the women we're investigating.
That was replaced by a single national force in 2013, now called Police Scotland. But he is an extremely experienced senior officer whose job is very relevant to the cultural and systemic issues we're looking into.
So work for Specialist Crime Division in Police Scotland, which is a national division. Detective Superintendent here, been in this role now for almost 3 years. So I look after, or the national lead for, rape and sexual crime, human trafficking and prostitution, and I've been police officer for almost 25 years.
Even if you weren't working in Glasgow City Centre at the time of these murders, was that something that you were aware of at the start of your career?
I think there was always I was more sort of Lanarkshire than Lothians based, and I think you always looked at what was happening in the city a bit different to what's happening in some of the counties, but I think you always had that understanding that the women that were maybe working in the city were always at higher risk, you know, and we'd always know that they were probably more, I guess it just goes with the territory, they're always going to be more at risk of who they're going to be exposed to and what guy they're going to come into encounter with. So there was definitely that knowledge, and I know, you know, certainly there's been cases, you know, of women that have maybe, you know, been in a car travelled out with Glasgow and things that would be encountered by the police locally.
So Stevie did know about the cases we're covering. Also that those working on the streets of Scotland's cities were in much greater danger. And crucially, that some women were being taken to remote second locations by the men who picked them up.
As we saw only too tragically in the case of Emma Caldwell. But we want to know if cases like Emma's and the rest of the women we've told you about would have been handled differently all those years ago.
You know, if there was a death that happened now, if it was one of the women that was involved in prostitution, absolutely, we'd be, so what have we got? Are we dealing with a sexual predator that's out and targeting women? There's a trafficking behind all this, but absolutely, I'd say, be treated completely differently to a mindset of, well, we've got a woman here that was involved in prostitution, and it's kind of a bit heartbreaking, actually. I think probably didn't get the attention it probably deserved, but I would say it probably treated completely differently nowadays.
Why did things have to change in the police?
I think through society, I think the whole thing. You know, I was actually at an event yesterday and it was interesting. So we started off with this view of prostitution back in the sort of the 90s. It started off with movies like Pretty Woman. This romantic idea, was that the view in the 90s of, it was quite a glamorous and it was almost out of sight, out of mind, where actually that story doesn't exist. You know, where we are from, certainly from what we see nowadays and the areas that we work on. So it's like exploitation at the highest level, and whether that is the human trafficking likes, the sexual crime, the kind of almost misogyny that's there about male entitlement, about I'm going to buy somebody for an hour or 2 hours, and once they're mine, I can do what I want to them. And it's that mindset of challenging that, saying that actually, you have no idea how wrong that is. And I think even the stuff that makes my skin crawl a bit is when you look at different things about, there's different websites out there that will do like punter review, and when you read some of the reviews there, it maybe shows you how challenging that's going to be to change a mindset of somebody. When you see how degrading and actually how horrible those comments are, we've got a long way to go to try and change a mindset. And it's going to take a lot of work, I think.
It felt important when Stevie admitted these murders would be approached completely differently now. That's not to say there weren't any individual officers at the time who took the murders seriously, even in the face of opposition. You've heard from some of them in this podcast, but they were pitting themselves against a system that ultimately accepted prostitution. The idea that it was the oldest profession in the world, something that was just part of life, and that women involved in it had a choice. The Pretty Woman reference is something we've heard a few times too, packaging up prostitution as something much more pleasant than it really is, romanticising it.
What stuck with me was when Stevie was talking about the male entitlement and the misogyny of buying another person for an hour to do with what they want. You could see how quickly that might lead to violence, or in these cases, murder. Also that what they're dealing with now is in the online spaces, that men are actually leaving reviews on the women they're picking up, in the same way you would a hotel room or an online purchase. And that the content of these reviews actually makes Stevie's skin crawl. It's completely dehumanising.
What is the kind of correct terminology around somebody who works in prostitution now? There have been so many hurtful terms thrown about in the past, and it is abuse. It's all abuse.
I've had this conversation quite a few times because I realised, as I said, coming into this, that I would automatically offend people the moment I walked in the room because I would say, I'm investigating prostitution. And my signature on my email would say, you know, lead for human rape, sexual crime, human trafficking and prostitution. And I guess for me that's the legal term that's in the legislation, so I will always go with that. But also mindful that, so I think in areas almost like to soften that down, it was sex worker, and I know our colleagues down south use sex work as the terminology they would use, and that they're comfortable with that. And I think that sends the wrong message up in Scotland, because, as you say, it's trying to legitimise sex work, where it is exploitation and abuse. From a policing side, I'll kind of stick to, you know, I guess the legal framework in it, prostitution or commercial sexual exploitation.
It's been difficult for us as well, you know, when we're trying to put this together and write it, hasn't it? We've had a lot of conversation about it, but I think, is it then maybe this imbalance of power and this abuse, no matter what you call it, that runs through the whole thing, doesn't it?
The issues that's in the centre of this about identifying as violence against women and girls and identifying different things, and there sometimes needs to be that agreement of whatever said that's not meant to offend in terms of terminology, actually trying to get to the root of the real issues here is a difficult part. But listen, 100% completely get that it's a really emotive area.
And that is a conversation we've had a lot. How do we approach this subject without hurting the loved ones of our victims? But an interesting thing Stevie says that we maybe hadn't thought of, there can be important reasons for using certain legal terms so that it's absolutely clear who is the victim and who is the criminal. Something we also talk about is that building trust and connection with women involved in prostitution is key to change.
Taking a step back to Glasgow then, and we've spoken to officers who used to work on the red light district in the 90s and the noughties, and they would be out on the beat and they would be on first name terms with a lot of these women who worked the streets back then. Does that still go on today?
So there's certainly liaison officers that should be in every area. I know sort of locally here in Edinburgh there are, I know Dundee there are, I'm pretty positive in Glasgow they've got the same. So that area of policing is something that unfortunately left, you know, when numbers cut, patrolling cut. We did lose a bit of that face, you know, the local community officer and who you could speak to, it definitely left. And now that's what we're trying to put back in place. So part of those patrols we're speaking about in Glasgow, some of the criteria we looked at was, can we try and get the same officers out rather than saying we send different? And there's a lot to be said about the old-fashioned sort of community police bobby that was out in the street and people would flag them down and speak to them.
Stevie gives an important perspective on the work that's being done now to tackle prostitution in Scottish cities. And you can tell he really cares about changing things for the better. But as we drove away from Fettes Road, we had to make sense of where this conversation leaves this investigation.
Yeah, so we've just left Fettes Road. I think we'd a productive conversation, certainly, about policing attitudes, and also how they are trying to tackle the much wider problem of violence against women than I think perhaps we even thought.
Yeah, Stevie was very vocal in saying that the police have made lots of mistakes over the years. You know, there was nothing that he wasn't keen to answer, but I feel like there are still so many unanswered questions around these cases.
It's been a good few months of calls and emails to try and make that police meeting work. I think we got a lot of good general information about how the police operate, but that doesn't really help these families,
does it?
It's not going to give them the closure that they want. And surely they can be given some kind of idea as to what's going on, or a bit of an explanation as to why there might be no answers and why some of these cases may never be resolved.
I thought I would have felt different coming out of that meeting. I think we've built up for it for quite a while, and all throughout this I've hoped at some point to feel like that we've actually made a difference in some way, that, you know, talking about these cases again, talking about these women again and their lives and putting them back in the spotlight might make some sort of difference. And I think maybe I'd built that, into the meeting today, and I maybe thought I would have felt like we'd come out with something a bit more concrete, whereas what I'm actually feeling like is just a bit numb, I guess, deflated.
We maybe thought that we were going to unpick a bit of that today, but we haven't really. That's what it kind of feels like. There's still a lot of pressing to be done, and that's going to take time.
Yeah. And we're not really any further forward than first thing this morning.
Yeah.
Because I guess what it comes down to is, even if police completely change the way they deal with similar crimes now, how does that help the families of victims in the 1990s and early 2000s? The families we're trying to help. It's worth reminding ourselves that a lot of women just didn't feel violence against them was taken seriously back then.
I would rather be sexually assaulted than go to Strathclyde fucking place. And that's the BL and end all of that. Fuck them, really, that's my opinion with them now. They, and see, after that court case when I come home, put the news on, I was really angry.
Do you think it was worse back then?
Why? Because I don't think police these days do this kind of stuff. Like, you know, I don't know. But I think it was more like, I worked in saunas and that, and the guys coming in, you knew they were, like, could be lawyers, and where it was right next to the sheriff court. My doctor used to go and see working girls on his lunch break. Honest to God. Couldn't make it up. They don't, there's no empathy about drug users, or we're just junkies to them. They would rather get you a fine and jail you than take you in and help you.
How did those interactions with the police, when they were being really dismissive of what you were telling them, how did that leave you feeling?
Vulnerable, for one. Just to go back out with broken fingers, blood, and I had to make money because the next man in the house, it was, never mind. Vulnerable, just weak. I don't know, like, disgusted, all that.
Other women have said to us that, you know, the way they were treated by police was terrible, and they were also telling us that basically some police would say to them, they would pressure them for sex so that they didn't kind of charge them. They would say, right, we'll make this go away.
That's so true.
Do you think that was happening?
No, I know it was happening because one tried at me, but I was too cheeky. And the amount of money they tried to give me, like, okay, you do this, I don't care.
So they were trying to put pressure on you?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then I seen him like a week later in a police van, but when they told me I was a police officer, I didn't question it because I could tell the way he was dressed. But then when I seen him in the van, I was like, oh, it was like more a, he really is. But I didn't doubt it anyway when he said it, because that's the way he treated you. Like.
That's Claire, who you heard from in episode 5, one of Ian Packer's victims. The woman who police thought bore a striking resemblance to Emma Caldwell. The one whose direct personality and strong-willed nature might even have saved her life. She's telling us that when she was working on the drag, as it was known then, she was pressured by a police officer for sex.
That some of the officers she encountered would rather fine a woman involved in prostitution than help them. And that shockingly, she feels she would rather be sexually assaulted than go through the hurt of reporting what happened to police. And she isn't the only woman we've spoken with making these allegations. But this isn't the whole picture. Most of the families we're working with had a good experience with at least some of the officers working on the investigation. As the Emma Caldwell case shows well, some of these officers pursued justice and the truth at all costs, but they were repeatedly dismissed.
So while DS Stevie and others believe things are different now, does that point to wider failings in the system at the time? Deep-rooted issues that existed elsewhere too, like in the media, which is something that we wanted to ask crime reporter Norman Sylvester about again too.
I certainly think in the newsroom that I've worked in, attitudes have changed. I feel like, you know, we are more aware of different issues now. Do you think you have more sympathy now than you did then, perhaps?
I think people are, you know, a lot more sympathetic now than people were then. I mean, I think that the problem for a lot of the women that worked in that generation, that 1990s, early 2000s, was that they were heroin addicts. It was seen as a sort of subculture, you know, obviously another world. Talk about the kind of unpleasant individuals like the Ian Packers, but there was a lot of men who were using these women that were respectable members of society. You hear all sorts of stories about members of the legal profession and justice system and people that would be outwardly respectable going in and using the girls' services. So I think it was a kind of like a hidden world, you know, and it was... The police didn't really deal a lot with it. They tended to deal with the girls as criminals, so they would get done for soliciting or stuff like that.
For these women, the fact that they may have been addicted to drugs or working in prostitution, that was mentioned first before who they were. You know, that was the headline. How does that sit with you now?
We don't talk about prostitutes or vice girls or hookers anymore. We had these hundreds of girls. They would stand in these street corners at all hours of the night, and we allowed it to happen. We can't imagine that happening now.
Do you think the language that the media used at the time had an impact on members of the public?
I think the language that the media used was the language that people used. You know, they were prostitutes, vice girls, hookers. We don't use these terms anymore. And I think also what's changed is, I think if when you go back, obviously it was quite depraved really, you know, not so much from the girls' point, women's point of view, but obviously the men. So I think the language has changed, a lot more sympathy now and a lot more understanding. Of course, the realisation that perhaps, you know, that what was a major problem has been replaced with something even worse, which is obviously people trafficking, sex trafficking.
I'll be honest, I probably shied away a bit from asking a more direct question there. Looking back, I really wanted to know if there are any stories that Norman would write differently now. If he's ever glanced back over an old article and winced, wondering if he'd pushed the envelope a bit far in the search of a front page lead. But then I'd need to level that question at myself too. I'm much newer to this game than he is, but I can still say I've felt a huge change in newsroom attitudes over the past decade or so. And going further back, he's probably right about the 1990s. That is the hurtful language that a lot of people would have been using. But did plastering it across headlines shrink any sympathy that readers might have felt? And surely it would only have strengthened any prejudices people already had, made it easier for them to walk past the women drifting onto the drag as the offices in the area were starting to close their doors for the day, to pull their coat tighter around them, quicken their pace, and avoid making eye contact with these vulnerable and abandoned women.
It would probably have reinforced any views that police officers held about these women at the time too, just as Davy Barr told us back in episode 2. And one other thing that Norman says there, that the men using the services were not just the Ian Packers of this world, that he's heard plenty of stories over his many years of crime reporting of so-called respectable men using them too. Men in the police and legal professions even. Remember that, as it will become important again soon.
And all of this left the women very much alone, feeling that they had to rely on their wits and each other, not the authorities. Which brings us back to the central pillar of this podcast, the spine which binds it all together, if you will. The Beware Book.
I seized it. I handed it in to, well, myself and my colleague seized it. We went to Base 75, which was a sort of drop-in centre for all the working girls. They could go in and they could get coffee. They gave them contraceptives, somewhere to go if it was raining, or, you know, the drop-in centres, I say. And there was a Beware book. At the time, I think it was on my first day on the inquiry, we were asked to go to Base 75 to pick this up. I wasn't fully aware what this book was. We were just to seize this book. I never read its contents, but the book was seized and it was taken back to the inquiry and handed over. That was my involvement with the Beware book.
So here we are. Stuart Hall, the former police officer who first interviewed Ian Packer in connection with Emma Caldwell's murder, he'd taken in the book from a drop-in centre known as Base 75, perhaps even on his first day on the inquiry, and he handed it into evidence.
Our jaws just about hit the floor when he told us all this. I allowed myself a quick side glance at Callum after asking the question, not quite sure I could believe the answer I was hearing, desperately trying to keep calm and not interrupt the flow of this crucial information. At this point in our investigation, we were researching everywhere we could think of. Charities, the council, police.
No one could tell us anything about the book, apart from the fact it existed. So we couldn't show that we'd been caught completely off guard.
What did it look like? So you go into Bay 75, can you remember this being handed? Did you ask for it? Did they volunteer it?
Myself and my colleague went in and asked for it. We had an action to go in and retrieve it. For some reason in my mind, for a number of years, I thought it was a book of condolence or something like that people were signing. But having thought about it, there'd been this Beware book. So we would have had an action to go in, seize Beware book, get a statement off the person handing it over. I'm so-and-so, I work here. The police arrived today and asked for this book. I have handed it over and I've signed this. That's the wee statement you take with it. So, does that answer your question?
Well, was it like, to the best of your knowledge, would it be like this physical notebook here?
Yes.
Was it like a wee book, or
was it
just quite a big book?
It was a bigger book. I can't remember if it was a hardback or not. I don't remember it physically. I just remember taking possession of a kind of biggish book. That's all I remember.
And then handing that into evidence?
Yeah.
And that was the last that it was?
Yes.
So how did it feel hearing that mentioned in court again? Because I guess there might have been a chance you'd kind of forgotten about that as well for a time. Were you surprised to hear it being mentioned again?
No. I was aware of it. As I think I explained earlier, as the years went on, I was trying to forget about more and more of the case. But then, you know, you get your citation for court and you have your statements and you're looking back and stuff, and things start to fall into place again. So no, I wasn't surprised.
It just felt like such an important moment. Stuart telling us that he is in fact the last person on record to have seen this book, the one we're so desperate to find. And we were enthralled as he began to tell us a little bit more about what it looked like. We now know it's perhaps A4 sized, judging by my notebook, the one we were comparing it to on that day in the studio. But actually, this is just the start of the revelations. It turns out we've been hearing from someone else who all this time has actually seen inside the book itself. Claire, who you may remember suffered a terrible attack at the hands of Ian Packer and was an important witness in the Emma Caldwell murder trial.
I'm sure it was blue. I could be wrong. But it's just like a, I was going to say a Bible, but
just a diary, almost, a sort of empty
diary. A bigger book, like
A4.
Mm-hmm. One book with a pen to write in that in Base 75.
Okay.
Pages it's been wrote on, and you're right. But where the other ones went, I do not know. And I don't think anybody will know.
So there was more, so that was the big one.
Just say, like, there was a lady attacked every single night. It's wrote down, not the same person, I mean, but when by the end of the year, this book is going to be full, like, because there's so many creeps. So where did this book go? In my opinion, it should have went to the police. But there's problems with Police Scotland as well, isn't there?
Who was in charge of taking it away once it was full?
I don't know. I did hear the council. And then another hand I heard the police.
What sort of things were the girls writing in these books, do you think?
Like, just being attacked. Like, I put in it, there was a taxi driver sitting, I don't know the street now, it's just up for Base 75, but he used to sit there every night and he just looked weird to me, and I put that in there. But there was, like, a lot of bad things in that book, but the police were always in Base 75. They could have done it with the book, rip pages out, score names out, I don't know.
So
I wish I did know. You know that? So, somebody says to me they went to the council looking for these books, and they said they didn't know where they were. And she's like, so you're trying to say you don't know where they are, so where these ladies are. So I think it should have been at the police, but then, if they're into all that, gone me working last season, degrading them, they would have took them. They would have took them away.
Do you think there would be police names in it?
Are you actually asking me that? Of course it is. Lawyers, police, all sorts.
I think that was the suggestion at the time.
Well, that's definitely a fact. You do something for police officers, you won't get to jail.
Claire's very casually telling us that not only had she actually written inside this missing book, the one we've been working so hard to track down, but without breaking stride, that she thinks the names or registration details of police and lawyers would be in it.
And if they were, they would have appeared alongside the very criminals it was their job to catch, men who'd carried out violent attacks on the women who worked on the drag. And it isn't just Claire. Anne, who ran the Salt and Light charity in the city centre, also thinks that wouldn't be too hard to believe.
You mentioned keeping a record of registrations of certain men that were around and coming in. Tell us a bit about that and what happened to that information.
That information has stayed with me, I would say, the last 5 years ago when I cleared everything, because Salt and Light... it no longer operated with the buses, that it was very much on phones, telephones, or the lasses could come here to see me. It just depended on who they were and what they wanted. And
do you remember anything about those records, anything about the registrations? People that we've been speaking to have made allegations that perhaps they were police officers and professionals involved in the legal profession that were also clients of the girls. Do you think that their names might have appeared on those records?
I wouldn't say names were put down. I would say registrations were put down.
But do you think that, from your experience, that police and people in the legal profession were clients of these girls? Or were using these girls?
I dare say. Yep.
Did they ever tell you about anything like that? Maybe kind of ever been roughly treated by police or anything like that?
No, I'm not getting into that.
That's fine. No problem. No problem at all.
I could sense not to push it any further with Anne there. I can understand why she might not want to speak to me about police potentially being clients of the girls she was helping, maybe even treating them roughly. And if we go back to what Claire was telling us just a couple of minutes ago, she thinks police could even have tampered with the book in some way, tearing pages or scoring out names or registration details, which would be pretty damning if true. Now, we obviously have to give police a chance to reply to all of these allegations, and if you keep listening, we will. We've also asked the local city council, which Claire told us might also have been regularly reviewing the books.
B75 was essentially run at arm's length by the council, and it's now been replaced by a similar service called Roots Out. And they've replied to us with a statement. It said, "A beware book was an informal safety measure used by women to share information about violent or aggressive men that they encountered. Also that this information was shared with police on a routine basis." It goes on to say that, in keeping with our general approach to document retention, information held in a beware book would not be retained over extended periods of time. And interestingly, they say that information that warns women about potentially dangerous men continues to be shared by the service, both verbally and digitally.
So while they say no information from the original books has been kept by them, some kind of verbal or digital beware book still exists in their service. It's also worth reminding ourselves just how long ago all of this took place. This book was last seen when it was collected as part of evidence in the Emma Caldwell murder investigation. Last seen by Stuart Hall when he handed it into evidence.
And when Colette happens to be following up with Stuart a few months after her first interview, about something else entirely, a small bit of admin to do with the podcast, it's while they're casually catching up, as you would usually do when you haven't seen someone in a while, that their conversation takes a sudden turn back to 2005.
Yeah, so when we spoke with one of Ian Packer's victims who was working in the town at that time, she remembered seeing the book. I think she said it was one of many. It wasn't just that there was one book, but, you know, once this book got filled up, they'd kind of start another one. Do you remember anything physically about the book? Was it small? Was it large? You know, do you remember anything like that?
As far as I remember, it was a kind of largish hardback book. The sort of, I don't know, a kind of heavy-duty kind of book you would relate to an accountant's office or something like that, you know, a big lined book. I think it was in the main body of Base 75 when we went in and it was handed over to us. We never, personally, I never read it at the time. I'd have a quick flick through it. It was, you know, different coloured pens and different handwriting inside. Messages from people to people or car registration numbers, things like that.
So Stuart's memory seems to have been jogged since our first interview months before, quite significantly. He's now telling us that he did actually see inside the book he would later hand into evidence.
The one no one has seen since. Now, he's not saying that he read it in meticulous detail or anything, but he is saying that his quick flick through was in fact long enough to see some of the car registrations and messages inside.
It also sounds like he's confirming what Claire told us too.
Our other kind of witness to that has described something very similar, so almost like a kind of A4 sized, yeah. Like an old, like, what did she, like a desk diary?
Yes.
Almost like, right, so yeah. Similar hardback, that's yeah. Interesting. And also just what you'd said, that in the pages, just kind of handwritten notes. Yeah. You think all different colours of pen then?
There have been diagrams in it, you know, people in it have been scribbling small pictures of, I don't know, maps or, you know, cars or... I don't remember specifics, I just remember general. It wasn't like a neat and tidy book. It was just like people came in and they would write comments on it. They weren't all... It was a lined book as far as I remember, but not everyone adhered to the lines. You know, things would be written kind of casually in it. That's about as much as I remember.
And as you say then, just having a quick flick through it, was there anything that kind of jumped out to you to begin with, or anything that you saw that you thought was quite unusual? Or
no, at that point I didn't know the relevance of the book. I didn't know the purpose, the reason I was seizing it. I wasn't fully aware of all the ins and outs of the inquiry and the locations and the persons involved or other victims. It was just a job. Go and seize that book and bring it back.
Did anyone at Base 75 mention anything as they were handing it over? Like, did they say anything about, you know, why the women were writing in it, or did they give any explanation as to what it was?
No, I don't recall anything like that. We were taking a brief statement from the person handing over. I don't remember the names. We would have been concerned in getting a correct signatures for the persons identifying the books, because the book would have become a production in the case had it contained anything evidential. I don't remember conversations around it.
A little bit more again there, that there were perhaps some maps drawn inside too. Now, to be completely fair about the details Stuart remembered about this missing Beware book and the timing of it, it must be said that he seized this in the early days of the Emma Caldwell murder inquiry, so it's entirely likely he wouldn't have grasped the importance of it at the time.
This case has also been so hard for him personally, one that he finds it difficult to talk about, one he's admitted to trying to forget about at times. And while it would also be reckless to speculate on what these maps or diagrams might have been describing, it is interesting to think that's the level of information the women were including in this book, which would make it quite an important resource. And that's something we asked Claire about.
Do you think, looking back, when women were writing in these books at the time, it wasn't taken as seriously? People weren't going through what they were writing?
It wasn't took serious. Or that guy we're talking about would not be walking all that time. I know he's not walking now, but I don't even know who went over the books. Or, as we say, where did the book go at the end? It's not just one book. Because I was wanting like nearly 20 years.
Were you encouraged to write in them, or were they just sort of there?
No, they were there just like, just say I get attacked and come back and wrote something in the book, just to, other girls looked at the book right enough. I think we were all that affiliate, like, didn't care. You had to be doing that.
Do you think that was this idea that yous were looking out for each other because you couldn't rely on the police? That was almost a way of warning each other.
I just put that thing about the taxi driver in the book, but other people might look in that book and think that, because the police weren't there. Good.
So Claire doesn't think the book was taken seriously by the authorities, that the information written in it wasn't really respected, or Ian Packer wouldn't have been walking all that time, as she puts it, meaning he was free for almost 20 years after murdering Emma, free from justice and free to attack so many other women. But Claire also tells us its importance wasn't always recognised by her either, that although she did use it to write about a scary ordeal with a taxi driver, she was too full of it, too in the grip of drugs, to see just how valuable it was. But also that she was aware she couldn't rely on the police to protect her or the other women working on the drag. And was she wrong to think like that? We asked Stuart about why the book might not have been processed properly.
Some of the former detectives that we've spoken to have actually said they had no idea about this book and it seems to have gone missing. Why do you think that is?
I wonder. This is an inquiry that I can't explain. I'm not surprised. However, let's be reasonable about it. This inquiry ran until about 2007, I think, from 2005 to 2007. We took over the gymnasium at Cathcart Police Office, Aikenhead Road Police Office, and the incident room was upstairs. So downstairs in this gymnasium were every production in relation to this case. Once the case had finished, all those things would be packaged up and taken elsewhere and cast to the wind. Don't know, no idea where that stuff went. They also have my notebook. I had to surrender my police notebook when I left that inquiry as well. So I don't know, there could be other reasons for it going missing. Packer may or may not have been mentioned in it a lot. Vehicles, they noted vehicles, they noted punters, as they called them. Their various names and nicknames and descriptions and who to look out for. So it would have been a very valuable piece of evidence. However, it would have been a very destructive piece of evidence if the bosses were looking to go down another line with inquiry.
So You think it could have been damning for them?
Yes.
It might not come across in the audio as much as it did in the studio, but I did detect a hint of sarcasm when I asked Stuart why other officers don't seem to know anything about the Beware Book or why it might be missing.
He's much clearer, though, about just how damaging the book might have been if it did in fact contain Ian Packer's name or details in it. A lot, as he seems to suggest. Especially when Strathclyde Police at the time had decided to go in a completely different direction from Packer in the Emma Caldwell murder investigation, down that Turkish cafe surveillance rabbit hole we told you about in episode 4.
He also tells us his notebook has gone missing too, and while it may have referenced Packer many times, it might have been used in a slightly different way, as he tells Colette during that second spontaneous chat.
Where would you think something like that might have gone, judging by other bits of evidence that you'd handed in? What would be your best guess?
If you're referring to my notebook, they may have had to refer to that actions I had taken at a specific time. When I left the inquiry, I left Glasgow and went back to work in the CID at Dumbarton. So it wouldn't have been... I understand why they might have seized it. Well, there are perhaps different reasons they could have seized it. But the most obvious and easily explained version would be that should they have any queries regarding anything I had, any of the work I had done, any of the people I had spoken to, those details would have been entered into that notebook and they would have had it on hand rather than have to make telephone calls to my office, depending on what shift I'm on, whether they could get hold of me or not to get the information that they need. So it would be for convenience.
And the Beware Book might be slightly different then, if that might not be a resource that they were maybe intending to refer to again. Where would be your best guess for that?
I would imagine the Beware Book would be an incredible resource for the inquiry. If these are the girls working on the streets and they're encountering the same people and Packer, vehicles, registration numbers, specific locations, actions taken by people, that would have been very valuable. That would have been kept as a production in the production store. The gymnasium at Cathcart Police Office became a temporary production store, but they also had cells or interview rooms or something at the office that they had used for productions. So ultimately, when the inquiry closed, I have absolutely no idea where those productions had gone. Obviously, they had put the four Turkish men to court and they had got off with it. Did they destroy all the productions at that point? I don't know. You would like to think forward-thinking Police Scotland wouldn't destroy them, but I've no idea.
So these are definitely questions we need to approach police with ahead of the upcoming public inquiry into the Emma Caldwell murder investigation. But before we can talk to them, there's something else we need to do too.
In episode 3, you'll have heard us calling Alice Wilson about her daughter Jacqueline Gallagher's case that we now know is under review. But unless we're very much mistaken, Alice doesn't. So we need to put that right.
It's when you're going back to places a year and a half later, isn't it? It feels so different. That's right. That's us. Oh, hold on. Oh, no. Alice is in hospital. Oh, dear. It says, sorry, never had contact details. Alice is in hospital.
Oh, that's a shame.
Oh.
And that'll have been left for us.
Right, okay. Do you know what? We'll leave a wee note then, maybe?
Yeah, maybe with
her
contact.
Yeah. Oh, goodness me.
And that is such a blow. Alice is in hospital. She's such a lovely lady who reminds me of my own mum a bit. And I won't lie, I'm a bit worried. I know Alice struggles with her health and that it's been made worse by the strain of what happened to her daughter, Jacqueline Gallagher, who you heard about in episode 3. We'd been so keen to explain to her the update on Jackie's case that it is now under review. So I popped back a couple of weeks later on my way home from work, just to leave another note for the family to check if she's okay and to let them know we're getting ready to meet with police. But when I ring the bell, I hear a familiar shuffle behind the door. And when it opens, I see Alice with a small smile, her little dog beside her. And I feel a huge sense of relief, only for that to be wrenched away when we sit down to talk on her living room couch.
I'm just so glad that you're back. I know you've had a tough start to the year. I'm just wondering how you're feeling about everything at the moment.
I'm really missing Robert. I mean, it's heartbreaking. That's my life partner, and I'm just absolutely shattered. I can't even talk to him. He's just he was my soulmate.
I remember you calling me to tell me that Robert had passed away. It just didn't feel real. He was such a kind and welcoming man. We first met him when he answered the door and led us inside to meet Alice. It hit so hard to think we wouldn't be seeing him again.
I just remember sitting in this room with you and Robert and, you know, how kind he was with you, and he was always had a wee word to look after you, and he really lit up when he was talking about nice. Jacqueline as well.
He was very kind. He was loving, and a lot of folk loved him. And I was absolutely shocked at his funeral, that the cremation bit was absolutely, there was another seat to be taken. You know, I just couldn't believe how many people turned up. There wasn't a seat, and I was shocked. There was that way of light. But you see, he never told anybody. He was just a quiet man. He just went about his business to do for the best for his family. And that's him. I've lost him.
I'm so, so sorry. And I just feel you've been through so much. And how much then is this kind of uncertainty around Jacqueline and not knowing what's happened? How much of a toll does that take on you?
Well, that really hurt him. I mean, he used to always talk about her and say to people, somebody must know something. You know, maybe like men in the pub talking, you know, somebody overheard something. I just wish he would come forward and take this misery away from me.
It really is just so sad how much this case impacted Robert, even up until his death, and how much strain it's still putting on her, which brings Colette back to the reason for her visit in the first place.
When I spoke to you on the phone before, I was telling you that we had a bit of an update, that the case is now under review. Now, what we want to ask is, what does this mean? Is this an automatic process, or, you know, what might happen from here? Is there anything you'd like us to ask around that?
Well, that would be helpful. I just want somebody to come forward. There must be a mother sitting the same as me, and they're shattered. I just can't concentrate. I can't go on with my life. I mean, she was my firstborn, you know, and she's a cheeky face, and I just wish I knew what was going on there.
What does justice look like to you now?
Well, I would like the police to go further and look into it. At the beginning, I feel that they weren't bothering because Jacqueline was being a prostitute. But then at the end of the day, she was a human being, and she was my daughter.
Does it hurt that you've not heard anything from police since the court case?
Well, it really does hurt. Well, I don't really know what's going on, but I just wish that they could find the person that's murdered Jacqueline, because I just can't get on with my life. I'm sitting here with my dog. I've lost my husband. What more have I got to go through?
Do you think that you're owed a sorry from the police, an apology or something, even a conversation, just to kind of update you?
Well, it would be nice for a conversation to let me know if they're still on the case. Their mind goes round and round and round, wondering what's happening. And You know, if they just came to my door and said, well, this is it. But they've no came near me. So I've been like another mother to be sitting the way I'm sitting. You know what I mean?
If you'd one wish, what would it be?
Oh, one wish would be for Jacqueline's killer to be caught. Because he must be doing it still, but he don't know my wee girl. He must be up the town or anywhere and picking up girls. And I just hope it's no turns into murder by another wee lassie. Do you know what I mean?
That was a tough conversation to walk away from. Knowing that Robert had passed away since the last time we spoke, that Alice was struggling with her own health and the weight of continuing uncertainty around Jacqueline's case. It doesn't seem like much to ask for, does it? Some kind of update on what's happening with the investigation for Alice or any of the other families we're working with. And I think we feel a bit of weight hanging on our shoulders too. When we started this investigation over a year ago, we made sure not to promise too much, not to give false hope to the families who've so generously shared their stories with us.
But we definitely owe them something, especially with so many questions still to be answered. It feels like time's against us too. Anything we learn now comes too late for Robert, too late for Diane's parents. We feel like we can't afford to lose another second. So we go back to the drawing board, trying to think of who can speak to us about these cases now. With a public inquiry into Emma Caldwell's murder investigation firmly on the horizon, it's proved a tall order to find someone in Police Scotland willing to speak to us openly about any of these cases.
But we need to know what is happening with the inquiry into Jacqueline's death and into Diane's and Marjorie's. We need to know what, if anything, it means for Jacqueline's case to be under review. We need to know why all of these families haven't been contacted by Police Scotland since it was formed in 2013. And we need to know what they can tell us about the Beware Book and where it might be now.
So we can't stop here, can we? We owe it to those who've given us their trust not to give up. So we give it one last roll of the dice.
We hit the phones, send out emails and reach out to all of our contacts again. And then we finally get a real break. The chance to ask the difficult questions about these cases and the missing Beware Book to someone who has the power to make a real difference. Into our inbox comes the opportunity we were pushing for and didn't think we were going to get. Confirmation of an interview with Police Scotland's head of major crime.
It's Colette and Callum from Clyde One.
Hi, yeah. Pleased to meet you, Paul Livingston.
Callum, nice to meet you.
Hi, Callum.
I'm Colette.
Hi, Colette, nice to meet you.
Thank you so much for taking the time today.
No, not a problem. More than happy to.
Okay.
Do
you guys want a coffee or anything?
Can I have a tea, please?
Sure, Colette.
A water for me, please. That would be great.
Thank you so much.
Firstly, if it's all right, can we just start with a quick name and title, please?
Yeah, Paul Livingston, Detective Chief Superintendent.
Tell me a bit about how the forces work to change the way it approaches, especially murders of women who were perhaps seen to be in vulnerable situations in the city centre of Glasgow since the 1990s.
Well, first of all, thanks for giving me the opportunity to take part in this podcast. We treat all homicides, all murders the same, and it should be the same level of service, the same thoroughness, professional investigation that the victim and their families receive, irrespective of background. We are constantly looking to improve. We are constantly reflecting on our performance. And certainly within major crime, that's something I do. I reflect on a daily basis on my own performance of the day, my team's performance, after every single homicide investigation is concluded. What I would say is we have come a long, long way. From when I joined, DNA was just in its infancy. That's come on so much in those 30 odd years. The learning process, it never stops. It's an ongoing process. That's what we'll continue to do to make sure that we're giving the best service to those victims and their families.
Why might some of the families feel like officers didn't necessarily show the women the respect that they felt they were entitled to?
That's a difficult question to answer because I've not been personally involved in every single investigation. It could be down to just inexperience of officers. It could be down to maybe a wrong strategy. As I say, the processes and checks and balances we have now to make sure investigations are full and thorough, it's very much better than it was back then. But again, I think maybe society's interpretation might have a lot to do with that. But as you know, certainly within Police Scotland, we do a lot of work, particularly in relation to violence against women and girls. We're very much victim-focused. So I can understand that things were done differently decades ago, and that's why families might feel that attitudes were different. But I think there has been a significant cultural change, and we're far much aware now of what we need to do to support victims, all victims, but in particular those that are most vulnerable in our communities.
So there is an acknowledgement from DCS Livingston, or Paul as he goes by, that not only are things different now, that attitudes might have been lacking 30 years ago, that he's regularly reflecting on performance and procedures in major crime, that he understands families might have felt let down by attitudes in the past, that constant change is needed to make sure that all victims, especially vulnerable women, are treated with the respect they deserve.
What I'd also like to say is that I do acknowledge the pain and the distress that's suffered by the families, and I'd like to actually reassure those victims and their families, we haven't forgotten about you or their loved ones. I suppose the obvious common factor is that unresolved status, and therefore there's a feeling of disappointment around someone not being held accountable for their loved one's death and ultimately brought to justice. I can understand that. We share those frustrations as well when we can't give families answers, when we can't bring somebody before the courts and hopefully get that justice for them. But again, I'd like to reassure families that their case isn't closed. We're continually reviewing it. When new information, new evidence comes to light, we do act upon it. When there's new advancements in technology or forensics, we'll go back and review the cases to see can we apply that to them. So it's never closed. We share those frustrations and we are keen to still provide answers to those victims. Whether it's years or decades later, we'll still work to try and get them justice.
That feels important. Paul is acknowledging the hurt and distress felt by the families we're working with, that he shares those frustrations and is working to get justice. But with the families telling us they've had no contact with anyone from Police Scotland since it was formed in 2013, how can they be expected to know this? And there's something else that comes out during our communication with police, to do with the original suspects in Diane, Marjorie and Jackie's cases.
But before we get on to that, let's remind ourselves, we already knew who the suspect was in Jackie's case. That was George Johnston, who stood trial for her murder but was acquitted when the jury returned a not proven verdict. We also know the man police spoke with following Marjorie's death, and while we haven't named him, we know he spent time with her on the night of her death. Although he was never treated as a suspect because Strathclyde police said no criminality was ever proven. But we do now have an update on the identity of the suspects in Diane's case, something that Norman Sylvester has found out as part of his reporting.
There was two names that emerged. One was Dale Clark, a 20-year-old sort of petty criminal, drug dealer, drug addict type from the Yoker area of Glasgow. And the other was, he was a slightly older male, Gary Moore. Now, Gary Moore was a different kettle of fish altogether, quite a fearsome individual.
That's right. Norman is able to give us the names of the two men who were set to appear in court in connection to Diane's death, but failed to make it into the dock when the Procurator Fiscal dropped the case. So what else has he found out about these two men?
Dale Clark was from, as I said earlier, the Yoker area, but Gary Moore from East End of Glasgow, probably a hard man and feared man, feared by criminals, who's feared by the girls that worked in the streets, and feared by a lot of other people quite higher up the kind of the ladder. Now, Gary Moore had stood trial in 1984, charged along with three other men for the murders of six members of the Doyle family. In the Doyle family, somebody set fire to the outside of the house. It's meant to be as a bit of a frightener, but six members of the family all died. Family members had been driving an ice cream van. There was a bit of a turf war between the sort of legitimate traders like Andrew and criminal elements that were trying to muscle in on the lucrative ice cream van routes.
The ice cream wars, quite a well-known chapter in Glasgow's criminal history. What does that say about Gary Moore, that he was linked to such a very high-profile crime?
I mean, Gary Moore is quite clearly somebody who was probably a bit of a hitman, a bit of a go-to guy, somebody you'd use to do frighteners, to rough people up. He was quite a frightening individual, one of these kind of guys with the kind of steely eyes, being linked one way or another to eight murders. So somebody who was violent, perhaps somebody who would lose control rather than being controlled violence.
You talked about the circumstances of the suspects appearing in court and then not going in front of a judge and kind of abandoned in quite unusual circumstances. I think there was also a suggestion at the time that Diane was rumoured to have potentially been a witness in an upcoming trial. Did you come across anything like that?
Yeah, there's another suggestion was that Diane, she was due to give evidence against a fairly senior figure in the criminal underworld in relation to a drugs matter. We don't know what the exact detail of that is. We don't know what the charges are. We don't know what might have been the consequences had she given evidence. But the suggestion was that somebody up in the criminal tree, probably certainly higher than Dale Clark and higher than Gary Moore, were concerned about her evidence. And maybe the combination of that and maybe her owing money for drugs may have been enough for someone to order her murder.
So some very scary guys then, Gary Moore especially, linked to several murders according to Norman, including a very high profile fatal fire connected to the ice cream wars, which we told you about in episode 6, when the gangland turf wars in Glasgow's housing estates were at their height in the 1980s. Six members of the Doyle family, including an 18-month-old child, were killed in an arson attack. All because one of the family, Andrew, drove a van along a particularly profitable route. A truly shocking episode in Glasgow's history.
But there's a reason why we can go into so much detail about these two men now, without fear of legal consequence. And that's because of something police tell us as part of conversations around the meeting we now sit in. It turns out these men are now dead, and so are the men connected to Jackie and Marjorie's cases, which is of course a blow. So we definitely need to ask DCS Paul Livingston what the consequences might be.
What happens to an investigation when a known suspect dies? Do you still continue to carry out inquiries?
Well, the death of a suspect doesn't preclude further inquiries being made and or a report being submitted to Crown Office Procurator Fiscal Service. What we'd say is each case is really unique. There will be several factors involved, but in general, factors such as the status of the suspect in any previous investigation, that would be considered. It may actually be that we say the word suspect, but it may well be that that person is an accused person, but there's just never been proceedings. We'd also have to review and assess any new information and its significance, and we would have early engagement with the Crown Office Procurator Fiscal Service about that to inform them and then carry out that assessment and make that decision going forward. It could well be that the investigation has a number of suspects and one of them might die, so we still have to investigate that. If there was just one suspect, we'd still look to do that investigation just to make sure we hadn't missed any other suspects as well. So these are sort of general observations, and I wouldn't really want to be drawn on any individual set of circumstances, but generally, the death of a suspect wouldn't stop us conducting that full and thorough investigation.
So the fact these suspects are dead doesn't mean an end to inquiries into the killings of Diane, Jackie or Marjorie. It's also worth pointing out that these men were only ever suspects. Any potential involvement of theirs in these murders was never proven. So could there still be someone else out there that was really behind them? And there's something else we want to know too. It's around that update that I gave to Alice before this meeting about the status of her daughter Jackie's case.
So what does it mean for a case to be considered under review?
So what I'd like to start by saying is that all unresolved and unsolved homicides remain under review. Basically, it means they're never closed. We will regularly go back and look at those investigations to see, is there anything more we can do? And if there is, we'll act upon it. There may come a time where we get to a stage where we've exhausted every line of inquiry and there's nothing for us to do at that moment of time. It will remain open, it will remain under review. So again, as I've already said, if there's new advances in technology, forensics, new investigative tools, and we become aware of that, we'll go back to see if we can use them to further any more investigations that we can do. Additionally, if a member of the public or a previous witness comes to us with new information or we receive new intelligence, we'll fully assess that, we'll explore it, we'll go back to the case, we'll see how it fits in with the original circumstances, and if we need to make further inquiries in relation to that, we will do it, and we'll update families in terms of that at an appropriate juncture. Under review doesn't always provide quick wins that we'd all love to get and give answers to families. They do come from time to time. We've had some recent successes over the years, but the process of identifying new opportunities and pursuing these is a really time-consuming process and can take years at times. But that doesn't stop us progressing inquiries in the first instance.
But that brings up another question. Why are we the ones finding out about their deaths? Why don't the families know all of this?
The loved ones of Diane McAnally, Marjorie Roberts and Jackie Gallagher, they've told us they have never been contacted by Police Scotland. Why might this be?
Well, first of all, could I maybe start with saying that we do have to exercise some caution around the discussion and specifics of an unresolved homicide investigation. And that's to protect the integrity of the investigation and any evidence that we've gathered, and also to ensure that if there were to be at some point judicial proceedings, that these discussions couldn't have a prejudicial impact on that investigation. So there's a really fine balance to be had, and I can understand how no contact could also give the impression that nothing's being done. However, that said, there should be regular contact with families, and if that's not the case, then I'll look to rectify that. What I would say is there was contact with Marjorie's daughter by Police Scotland back in 2015, and that was following a press article which incorrectly stated that the case was closed. So we did contact them to say that no new information had been received at the time, the family were updated and contact details passed. Now, there could be a number of reasons why there's been no contact. And again, going back to some investigations that I don't have first-hand knowledge to, it may well be that the member of the family who was a point of contact at that time has moved on, passed away, etc. There's a new next of kin that we've to update, and there hasn't been that discussions about how much contact they want. It's something that we are actively looking at to see how we can improve that. As I've said, we're always looking at new processes and what we can do.
In previous conversations that we've had, you spoke about getting into the police because you really wanted to help people. You wanted to help people like the families involved in our investigations. Can you understand on a human level why these families might feel hurt, why they might feel let down?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course I can. Understand that in relation to, again, unresolved homicides or those deaths where criminality cannot be established, that families are fighting for justice for their loved ones, they want those answers. I 100% understand that, and we want to do everything that we can to give families answers, but sometimes we just can't, and that could be down to a number of factors out with police control or the investigation control. Understand that they'll feel let down because ultimately no one has ever been convicted or held accountable for their death or their loved ones.
Can you understand why they might feel they're owed some sort of apology or acknowledgement?
I absolutely acknowledge the pain and distress to the families, and I know that the status of the investigation is unresolved will form a basis of that disappointment. But again, I'd reassure the families, we are doing everything we can, and when we get new information, new technologies, we will act upon it to try and resolve that or at least give them some answers. If there are any areas of failings or learning were identified, then of course I would offer an apology.
I feel a wave of emotion when I hear that word, apology. It's a word we hear often in day-to-day life, but in this context, it just feels like it means so much more. That a sorry is in fact merited, if there have been areas of failings, as he puts it, in the past. Maybe the emotion is relief, or just that very human feeling of being acknowledged. Whatever it is, I feel like I want to bottle it up quickly and pass it straight to the families before it escapes. As just a passenger in their journeys for such a brief time, I can only wonder what that word will mean to them. DCS Livingston has also acknowledged there should be regular contact between Police Scotland and the families, and that he understands why they might feel disappointed by the lack of progress in their loved ones' cases, or for some of the families, a very long wait for answers.
Tracy Wilde's family waited a similar amount of time for justice as Emma Caldwell's. Why did her family not receive an apology as well?
What I would say is I can't and I won't be able to be drawn into discussions that centre around the circumstances of the mother of Emma Caldwell. As you're more likely aware, there is a public inquiry ongoing that will focus on this investigation. In relation to the murder of Tracy Wilde, this is, however, now a resolved homicide, and that was following the conviction of Zee Min Chen at Glasgow High Court back in 2019. Its resolved status allows us to discuss the specifics of that investigation in a little bit more detail now, but the conviction of Chen was made possible, in my opinion, as a direct result of the determined police inquiries at that time of the original offence. I did work briefly, very small part on that investigation, and I saw the amount of resource and the commitment and the dedication for the officers that were on it. But ultimately, Chen was identified following his fingerprints and DNA being taken in 2018, which was in relation to an unconnected offence. That was then matched to significant forensic results that were seized and preserved from the initial investigation. So what I would say is that the fullness and thoroughness of that original investigation obtained, secured and preserved that evidence so that years later we were able to make that identification, make the arrest, present the evidence before the court, get the prosecution and the conviction and give that answers to the family. So for me, the work of the original investigation team and, I would ask, add my homicide governance review team ensured that that evidence remained available for use over 20 years later, which I am sure became absolutely critical in securing that plea of guilty.
As DCS Livingston says, he can't fully compare Emma Caldwell and Tracy Wilde's murder investigations because of the upcoming public inquiry. But in praising the fullness and thoroughness of the evidence gathering following Tracy's murder, he seems to be hinting about the decisions made during Emma's. We've also reached out to the Crown Office and Procurator Fiscal Service about Tracy's case too, and asked about the fact her killer sentence was reduced to 16 years.
And they've replied saying their part in proceedings usually ends on verdict, and that sentencing is a matter that is entirely for the presiding judge and the courts. So we can go to Bernadette with this update then, but what about the families whose cases remain unresolved? Despite Paul outlining some of the difficulties and how best to keep families up to date, he does give us an important assurance, something which has hopefully made our investigation worthwhile.
Over years, it could be that family dynamics have changed. Who was our point of contact is no longer the point of contact. We've not been updated in relation to that. People could move away, change address, change phone number. But we're also conscious of the need to manage families' expectations, not raising hopes, and we're conscious that what may be acceptable level of contact for one family may not necessarily be what another family would want. What I would say is that I'll ensure that detectives reach out to the families of Diane, Marjorie and Jackie and seek to explore in some detail what information we could hopefully provide to them.
We have been working with these families for quite some time. We have been able to build up a good contact with them. Would you be open to us asking if they might be open to starting a conversation, if we could, you know, pass on any details or anything like that.
Yeah, absolutely. More than happy if, with the farmer's consent, if you would like to pass those details on. What we will then do is we'll check those details with our records to see if they're the same contact details that we have for the family. And if so, more than happy to get in touch with the families and provide them with whatever information we can and hopefully answer any questions that they have.
So DCS Livingston is open to us sending over contacts for the families of Diane, Marjorie and Jackie, and for some of his officers to reach out to them to start a much needed and long awaited conversation. But while this does feel like another win, why has it taken so long? Why has it taken for us to sit down in this meeting here today?
And there's something else too. This is a very sensitive interview, one we didn't really expect to get. And Police Scotland has asked for certain assurances ahead of our meeting. A lot of the time, journalists are free to ask whatever questions they like, and it's up to the interviewee how or if they answer them. But on some occasions like this, we're asked to give over a list of questions in advance for it to be agreed upon.
And one of the questions that was originally considered off-limits centres around something you'll be very familiar with now, something we're desperate to find, that we didn't even think we'd be given the chance to ask a question about until a spur-of-the-moment decision on the day.
A big part of our investigation has focused on the Emma Caldwell murder inquiry, the initial inquiry. As part of that, we've also come across something called a Beware book. We've spoken to a police officer who said that he handed it into evidence as part of that initial Emma Caldwell murder inquiry. We want to put this to Police Scotland, but why might that be difficult for Police Scotland to talk about either of these things at the moment?
I wouldn't say it's difficult for Police Scotland to talk about it. What I would say is it wouldn't be appropriate for Police Scotland to talk about it with the upcoming public inquiry. And I wouldn't want to say anything that would undermine that process. What I would say is, though, that Emma's family have shown great courage and determination following her murder back in 2005. And Police Scotland are absolutely fully committed to supporting that inquiry and getting the loved ones the answers that they deserve.
So it isn't exactly a definitive answer. Police Scotland hasn't suddenly produced a record telling us exactly which shelf this book is sitting on, in which evidence room, if indeed that's where it is at all.
But it does give us some much-needed insight that, as Stuart Hall rightly told us earlier, the existence of this book is tied to the upcoming public inquiry into Emma Caldwell's case. And to talk about it right now might undermine the work of that inquiry. So it seems like the hunt into finding this book remains firmly on.
But anyone wanting to find out more will do well to pay close attention to this inquiry, which is getting underway. And it's now that we hear of something else that might be relevant to the inquiry too. Something that stops us in our tracks.
So I got an email from the Crown Office saying that they're looking into possible criminal activity with senior police.
You'll have heard this voice a couple of times now. Magdalene, she's Ian Packer's first known victim. And she's telling us that the Crown Office and Procurator Fiscal Service, or COPS for short, emailed saying it's looking into whether the decisions made by officers during the first investigation into Emma Caldwell's murder may have broken the law.
And that was in 2019. And that was from the Crown. So I've asked them about that. They just won't answer the question. Where is this? So I'm asking now, Dorothy Bain, can you please provide a copy of the outcome of the investigation on senior police and possible criminal activity, the one that Alexis Blake was talking about, and the one that I've actually emailed to you. I've emailed this to you. I've emailed you all the communications over the years, and I've shown you that that the Crown were just ignoring my requests. So can you please share that with me? Because you won't talk to me.
That is pretty unusual. While it's not unheard of for officers to go through internal reviews if a complaint's made against them, It's not often we hear of reviews into whether an officer's actions were potentially criminal. Magdalene's also telling us she was notified of this by Assistant Procurator Fiscal Alexis Blake in 2019, and that any attempts to clarify this with the Lord Advocate Dorothy Bain have gone unanswered.
So we've put that to COPS, and in a statement they have confirmed the Lord Advocate, that's Dorothy Bain who Magdalene mentioned there, did instruct that there should be an independent investigation into potential criminality by police officers in this case. She made that instruction in March 2024. So why haven't we known anything about this until now? Well, there's something else too. COPS tells us it hasn't been able to carry out this investigation yet because of what it calls pressures on UK-wide policing resources. Although it does say discussions are ongoing to explore options for this being taken forward.
And the statement doesn't end there. It finishes by saying that COPS fully supports the independent public inquiry, also that it will cooperate appropriately with the chair and inquiry team to help deliver answers for Emma's family and the public. Finally, it says that the service's last correspondence to Magdalene was in May 2024.
So lots to discuss around the upcoming inquiry then. The decisions made by senior officers during the initial Emma Caldwell murder investigation will be firmly in the spotlight, as will the evidence handed in as part of it. That is the now missing Beware book. There will be questions around how the investigation was carried out, and quite unbelievably, if any laws were broken during it.
Something which officers like Stuart Hall and Davy Barr will no doubt watch with interest. And all of those who loudly and continually voiced their suspicions about Ian Packer, only to be ignored.
There will also be questions about Packer's offending. Is it even worse than we first thought? Has he attacked women in the US or Spain too? Or might he even be responsible for other murders, which are accusations which we heard in episode 5?
And while all these queries hang in the air, there remains a bigger question for the families we've been speaking to. What hopes can they realistically have for justice after all this time?
This has been a long investigation for us. We've found it very difficult to get information on these cases so many years later, or even to find, you know, people willing to talk about them. How difficult is it to prosecute these so-called cold cases then?
Okay, I do understand the term cold case. It's a common phrase, it's widely used and reported, but it's actually not a term that we officially recognise. Personally, I don't like it, because I think it gives sort of connotations that would suggest that a case is sitting on a shelf, going cold and gathering dust, but the reality is it's very, very different. So we refer to them as unresolved, undetected, unsolved, etc. None of our unresolved homicide investigations would ever be closed, and our homicide governance and review team, they are actively reviewing unresolved and unsolved homicides throughout the year. You are right though, in general terms, that investigating an inquiry that happened decades before, and probably there's some of my detectives doing that now that weren't even born when that happened, it is really challenging. But Police Scotland is good at investigating. We've got a lot of talented investigators out there, uniformed officers, detectives who know what they're doing. We are always looking to improve in what we do, and that includes our training as well. Sometimes it's just about even just going back over, checking, double checking, clarifying, maybe asking questions that initial investigators maybe didn't think of or forgot to ask, and that can give new information as well.
Unresolved cases or cases that are under review, what might it take at this stage to kind of fully reopen a case like that?
The decision about an unresolved case moving from under review to being a full investigation, or maybe even a reinvestigation, that could come from direction from the Crown. That could come from new information coming in, intelligence coming in, a change in technology, advances in forensics, and we are very, very careful about that, because what we don't want to do is give families and victims false hope. So we're really careful. There's a lot of discussion an agreement at really experienced levels, there's more investigations to be done, then that's when a case would move from that, as you say, under review to further investigations.
You're a very experienced officer. You've been involved in so many investigations up until this point. Is it your experience that a murderer could live their full lives without, you know, letting something slip or saying something? Is it your experience that, you know, someone usually knows something?
Again, that's a really difficult question to answer, and it's something I've probably thought about. What I do believe is that taking a life must bear a significant burden on an individual. And I can only imagine that knowing about someone taking a life who hasn't yet faced justice must also put a similar sort of burden on those people. Therefore, again, if there's anybody out there that suspects or knows or believe that someone's responsible, you know, come forward to us, tell us, let us assess that, lift that burden, let's help you lift that burden, and we'll take action on the information that you give us.
And what message do you have for anyone listening? Maybe they've got a slight inkling that they might know something, but they're not sure how important it is, especially after all this time.
Please don't sit on it. Don't let it eat away at you. I would urge them to come forward. Have the trust and confidence in us. We will listen to you. We will take that information on board. We will act upon it. We'll research. Let us be the judge of if that information's important or not. It could be that final piece in the jigsaw that gives families much needed answers, gives them justice that they and victims deserve.
I think we're starting to understand just how difficult it is to investigate these cases after so many years. That perhaps these brutal and tragic murders have crushed so many lives so profoundly that their impact is still as far-reaching as it is painful.
As it is for Alice, whose daughter Jacqueline she's still determined to find justice for, despite all of the heartache she's been through in this year that marks the 30th anniversary of Jacqueline's death.
That's my husband passed away, and I don't know how long I've got because I've been myself too. And I just wish that this person was caught. I know it's been a long time, but somebody must know something. Maybe even the girls up the town, and they're no coming forward because they're scared. And I just wish they would open up and end this misery for me.
Or for Dolly and Shirley, who we met all the way back in episode 1, when we also take a trip to go and see them, to ask them how they feel about all the updates police have given us, as some of Diane McAnally's few surviving relatives.
It's just the mother and father's dead now, so I think if it would put everybody at ease if they could just find somebody. Obviously it's going to happen straight away, but you never know. You just never know. Somebody might remember something, or it'll come to them, or what. But we're happy as they've came and gave us an update. So yeah, somebody like you yourself is looking into it. You know, you alone, you're keeping this going.
Yeah.
You're the one keeping this going.
It would just be
a cold case, you know what I mean? A cold case stuck away in a drawer somewhere, you know what I mean? But you've kept us going. Really grateful, really, really grateful for what yous are doing through yous.
And that is such a relief to hear, that by talking about these women, these daughters, mothers and sisters again, maybe we have made a difference to these incredible families.
We've investigated each case and given definitive updates to each of them. We've had confirmation that the police will meet the families in person if we're able to check contact details with them.
And crucially, we've heard an apology for any past failings. We've also identified that the Beware Book was handed into evidence as part of the Emma Caldwell murder investigation, and by who.
And if it were to turn up, that it would be hugely important evidence in the public inquiry, which is now just gathering steam. An inquiry which will examine what went wrong in the investigation carried out by Strathclyde Police, including the direction given by the Crown Office and Procurator Fiscal Service, and what decisions might have been made to apprehend Ian Packer sooner.
An inquiry that listeners of this podcast will surely watch with interest. I think this whole time I've dreamt of answering every question, solving every case, and delivering this missing Beware Book on a silver plate. But maybe that isn't what this is. maybe this is a beginning and not an ending.
That while the invisible strings joining these women in life and death can't be tied in a neat bow, we have gone some way to strengthening the bonds between them.
Maybe these cases are more like jigsaws, which we've been able to gather more pieces of over the past year or so. That perhaps one more crucial piece might be all it takes to complete the puzzle. One you might well hold without even knowing it. That someone must know something.
If you've been affected by any of the issues raised in this podcast and need mental health support or want to talk about your feelings, visit the Hub of Hope to find services in your area. If you think you might have information about any of the people we mentioned, you can get in touch with us at bewarebook@bowermedia.co.uk.
Beware Book was written, created and presented by me, Colette McGonagall. Presented and produced by Callum McQuaid. The executive producers are Lawrence Bassett and Henrietta Harrison.
Sound design is by James Stodd and Michelle Holman. The designer is Ben Watkins. The production manager is Sarah Nichols. Legal counsel by Jonathan McNall for Bower Media Group and Caroline Marshall for Reviewed and Cleared.
The head of production is Kat Moran. The chief creative officer for podcasts is Lucy Cave. With special thanks to the Director of News and Sport for Scotland and Northern Ireland, Lorraine Herbison-Hollinshead, and the Clyde One News team.
Beware Book is a Rail Original podcast by Bower Media.